History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there that should never go untold. And by now we know they don't have to, as long as we're willing to take a little action, take some initiative, ask some questions, invest some time in listening. You'll be amazed by what you end up hearing. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. Of course, we want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really do find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. This week brings us a special day that for many Americans flies right by without them ever hearing about it. Did you know that more than 80,000 American service personnel are still missing from previous conflicts? For their families, the dream remains to bring them home someday, some way. And making sure they are never forgotten is a big reason that National Prisoner of War and Missing in Action Recognition Day was established in 1979 through a proclamation by then-President and World War II veteran himself, Jimmy Carter. So for the last 45 years, the third Friday of September has been POW/MIA Recognition Day. And that means this coming Friday, September 20th, is the day our country stops to remember all of those whose families are still waiting for them to come home, not to mention everyone who's ever been a prisoner of war. 725 Americans became prisoners of war during the Vietnam War. There have only been 37 since then. Prior to that, we saw over 7,100 Americans taken into captivity during the Korean War and over 130,000 American POWs during World War II. I'd encourage you to do a little digging and look for a POW/MIA Recognition Day event in your area. And we're going to hear the memories of a couple of ex-POWs today, starting with a World War II veteran who's going to turn 100 in a couple months. Joe Peter Burrs was a fighter ace who would go on to fly in Korea and Vietnam as well, but on April 10th, 1945, shortly after shooting down one of the first German jet fighters, an ME-262, in his P-51 Mustang, Joe was hit by ground fire just after shooting down another enemy aircraft.
It blows up, and I'm pulling off, and I feel another thud. And I get oil over the windscreen, and so I'm pulling up, and I get up to 10,000 feet, and much altitude as I could. Then I try to manipulate it. There was some kind of a procedure. You manipulate the throttles, mix your prop control and that sort of stuff, and you get better performance or some performance on the engine. So I'm deciding whether or not to go to the east or the west. The Russians were closer, and they were to the east. And we were briefed that the front lines, the Allied front lines, were in the Magdeburg area. And Magdeburg's about 80 or 90 miles from where I am. So I decided to go to Magdeburg. I'm losing altitude all along, and I'm down to about 1,000 feet. I'm over Berg, which is a suburb of Magdeburg. It's just outside of Magdeburg. Anyway, I'm down to about 1,000 feet, and so I think, hell, I'm going to have to bail out. So I unstrap everything and get ready to, and I catch out of the side, my right side, I see this FW-190 coming in at me at my 3 o'clock position. My aircraft is burning by now. And so I pull into him. He fires his rockets. It misses. And by that time, I look, I'm down to 500 feet. I'm too low to bail out. I got to belly this thing in. So I'm looking, please, I can't belly it in. I've unstrapped. I'll kill myself. So, of course, this is all milliseconds, of course, going on in your head and stuff. And it's training that is, you just do this stuff automatically. You know, new circumstances, other circumstances, things are popping through your mind, and you know what to do once you learn the circumstance. So anyway, I have to go out of the left side because the right side is burning. I mean, the fire is coming out of the right side of the engine. So I pull out, I get out in the wing and let myself go. And as published, I hit my knee on the horizontal stabilizer, pull the ripcord. My chute opens and I swing once and hit the ground hard. So at that time, I think, well, I better find out what's going on and where I am. I get up and I look around and, oh, for nothing, not a tree for 300-400 yards. And there's a group of 10 or 12 civilians coming at me. And so I'm looking at them, I think, I'm going to really get it. And about the same time, when they get to about 50 yards from me, a Luftwaffe sergeant comes tearing up on a motorcycle, stops, and stops the civilians from taking me. He said, no, you know, he pulled out his Luger, and he's going to protect me, which is good, because there were quite a few that were killed by civilians on that mission who were bailed out from that mission from the bombers. Anyway, about the same time, about four or five elderly gentlemen, probably in their 30s, 35, came out. And one was probably in his 50s or 60s. And he was the chief of police, wearing a leather hat. And he had a left arm. His left hand was a black leather glove, you know, probably lost his hand during World War One, but it was right out of one of Eric Stroheim's movies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Typical. That's what I was thinking at the time. And anyway, they take us into town. Sergeant says, okay, you can question him for a while. We go into probably the Burgermeister, the town hall or whatever they called it, and people are starting to gather outside. They're getting a little noisy. But anyway, we get in, and they're searching my clothes and everything. They find a rosary that I always carried in my flight suit. They say, oh, I'm told later from the sergeant, they're saying, how could this Catholic be killing innocent men and women and children and stuff like that? You know, well. And the chief of police, he pulls out his Luger and actually puts it to my head. He said he wanted to shoot me on the spot. And the sergeant pulled out his Luger and said, we're leaving. I'm going back to the base. So things quieted down. He took me out, put me on the motorcycle. By that time, the cows around was getting a bad crowd out there. So he takes me. He was stationed at a major airfield at the Berg. And that's where he goes. And then they put me in the local jail at the airfield, and I'm questioned by the Kassavo for, you know, no torture or anything like that, but it's just questioning for about 2 days. Then they bring me down to the train station and put me on a boxcar, I was waiting for the train, and them to put me on the boxcar, and one of the railroad guys, he comes up to me. He says, hey, you want a schnapps? I don't know what schnapps is. I take a swig of that, and wow.
Hello.
Those are, just little things that it's hard to remember all the details around it, but I remember him giving me a schnapps. So I get on the train, and it's probably a couple hours. We get off, and I'm at Stalag 11, which is a POW camps mainly occupied by British, but they had already evacuated the camp, and there was only about 100 Tommies left, and so we were put on a forced march. The next day, we started marching.
Lucky you.
off back to Berlin, where it all started, you know. And so we have 6 or 7 days of the march, and of course, it was just people, just refugees going from the east and the west, and just pandemonium, motorcycles running up and down the road. The military vehicles were trying to get by and this sort of stuff, too. And they were just trying to get the traffic moving, and it's just hopeless. And then, to top it all off, a couple of times we were strafed by our own fighters, you know. And we survived that. I got to Stalag 3 at Luchtenwalde, which was a mostly Russian and some Scandinavian POWs. There were, I think, about four or five of us Americans. Tracy was there. He had ended up immediately after the strafing was over. They sent him to Berlin, to Tempelhof, and then down to Luchtenwalde. So he was there. And two of the sergeants that were on B-17s that were shot down that we were escorting were there. And Lieutenant Stewart, who was strafing another airfield, was from our unit, was there. So I get there, and they already were planning escaping. One of the sergeants could speak fluent Russian, so they said, okay, we're going to get out of here and get in contact with the Russians. So I said, hey, I'll go along. And it was, the escape was basically, you know, the security was practically non-existent. There were a few guards around. It was just a matter of going under the fence at night, which we did. And we went down about, probably walked about 5 miles along the road towards Berlin. And here comes a tank unit rolling down the road. The sergeant, we were hiding in the ditch, and the sergeant jumps out, says some Russian stuff to him, and waves us out. And we come out, and they throw me a gun and hop on the tank, and off we are to fight the Battle of Jitterbug and Wittenberg on the Elbe. So in Jitterbug, I'm out on the patrol with a sergeant, a Russian sergeant. We come to a complex, civilian complex, housing complex, and really nice apartments and this sort of thing. So he's in there, and he is really bad. And he tells us to get aside, get out of the way. And he gets in the middle of the room with a burp gun. And he just stands with that room and destroys every, you know, they had nice radios and all nice furniture. And he just stood in the center of the room laughing like hell and just spraying everything. And I'll never forget that. I thought, this guy's a little nuts. You know?
It's the Russian rage at destroying German property,
yeah.
Basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I want people to catch that, because this, your story is pretty unique. There are not too many guys who can tell a story like this. So you're shot down. If that Luftwaffe officer doesn't come over, you're probably dead right there at the hands of civilians. Mm-hmm. He saves your life. You're a prisoner. You end up on a forced march. You survive that. The next POW camp, you escape, which the odds were overall in Europe in POW camps, not good for trying to escape. But you do that. And then, since you run into a Russian tank outfit, all of a sudden you're part of the Red Army.
Yeah.
You're fighting the same enemy, but for a different country.
Right.
You can't make this stuff up.
I know.
So now you're actually an infantryman in the Red Army.
Right. And then from Jitterbug, we go all up to Wittenberg, and we have a few skirmishes on the way. Not major, but dead bodies, German bodies, laid, you know, soldiers all over the place. As you're going by, that, you know, for a guy that's a fly, you know, we don't get close to the war. And I really increased my appreciation for what the ground troops do, because it was, you know, it's a horrible situation, you know. You just can't even compare. It's there's no comparison at all between the things you go through in the air and the things you go through on the ground. It is just, I mean, the leadership and the bravery and everything that's involved in fighting on the ground is so much surpasses what's in the air.
Well, and I guess the other question I have to ask you, because you told us the circumstances of your bailout, and even that, your odds of surviving a bailout from that low altitude the way you did are not strong. But I have to imagine that you weren't in the best of physical shape after that.
No, I had sprained my legs, and I had some burns on my leg and my arms. But it was, you know, 20 years old. I hope you could take that.
All right. I feel for you. It's apparently you don't feel for yourself in that situation. No big deal. You were just tough enough to handle
that's
it.
That's right.
So now you're fighting with the Russian army, and this is getting close to Germany's surrender.
Yeah. Okay, and we're up about, we're at Elbe, at Elbe on, and, I mean, at Wittenberg, and our U.S. Army patrol comes across, and, oh, the group of us that escaped, I forgot to mention, someplace after we passed Jitterbug, I noticed, I was, you know, we were separated throughout the thing, the column, and I lost contact with all the other Americans. I was the only one left.
And you don't speak Russian.
And I don't speak, you know, I could speak a little German, and we could do, and the Russian lieutenant could speak a little English and a little German too. So we were able to get some, but I couldn't get any really solid idea of what's on. When we get to Wittenberg and the patrol comes across, they're sort of hiding me. The Russians are sort of keeping me out of sight. They're not, you know, hey, here's your buddies coming in. They were keeping me out of sight. And fortunately, the team leader, the patrol leader, saw this flight suit. He knew it was an American flight suit, so he started talking to the lieutenant, you know, who's that back there? And they had some discussion back and forth, and reluctantly, he released me to the patrol. But anyway, well after the war, over 60 years after the war, I find out from Sergeant Lewis, who We came in contact with each other. He was one of the escapees, the sergeants. We came in contact through a mutual German researcher. Oh, back in, it was, I think, about 1998 or 9 or something like that. And he told me, he said, that a American general came around, over and met the Russians, and they took all of those guys back with him. And I'm thinking, well, what the hell? Why was I left behind? Didn't they tell him that there was another guy in it? Or was there some kind of a, I have no idea. And I'm the only guy left now, so it's impossible. But it's a fog of war that I'll never understand.
So according to that version, all the Americans had been reclaimed from the Soviet unit.
Yeah.
And it sounded like you were saying the Soviet commander was reluctant to let you go.
Yeah.
What do you think would have happened to you if you had to stay with those guys?
I think I was just a pawn for, at this time all the political stuff was going, Potsdam conferences, all this was going on. Patton wanted to continue the war to go Russia. So there was, and I think maybe they just, I have no idea, absolutely no idea. And I didn't really give a crap back then when I was really just having a lot of fun. No, I was taking care of myself.
XPOW Joe Peter Burrs will turn 100 in November. This past June, he visited Normandy with our friends at the Best Defense Foundation, who right now have a group of World War II vets in the Netherlands for the 80th anniversary of Operation Market Garden. You can learn more about the great work they do at bestdefensefoundation.org. And when we come back to this special POW MIA edition of Hometown Heroes, another ex-prisoner of war captured during the Korean War. Some of the things he survived are hard for most of us to envision. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special edition this week dedicated to National Prisoner of War and Missing in Action Recognition Day, which arrives this coming Friday, September 20th. In some areas, they'll wait till the weekend for recognition events. In some areas, they've already had special events. I had the privilege of attending one of those in Clovis, California this week that really brought home the importance of never forgetting those who our country is still trying to find. About half of the more than 80,000 Americans still listed as MIA are considered lost at sea, but most of the rest of them are believed to be recoverable. I mentioned that over 7,000 Americans were taken prisoner during the Korean War. More than 2,700 of them died in captivity. One of those who survived and eventually published a riveting book about that experience was the late Ken Eaton. His book is called Missing Dog Tags.
My outfit had been... We had completely defeated the North Koreans, and I'd been all the way up to the Yalu River, or within about 50 miles of that, when the Chinese attacked. and we fought a defensive thing for several weeks till we got back to, I was south of the 30th parallel when the Chinese set a line there and continued to attack us. My platoon had been assigned to Rock Division, which was, or pardon me, regiment, which was fighting some Chinese cavalry in a valley called Hongsong, about 3 miles north of this village. My platoon of tanks was there to give them the available 75-millimeter, or pardon me, 90-millimeter guns to try to hold the Chinese when we were overrun by the Chinese. And after 3 days, and I was captured on the February 11th after my tank was, we'd been hit with a 3.5 bazooka, and it came inside the tank and blew up and killed three of the people within the tank, the driver and I. Well, the loader actually got out and died later, you know. Got out of the tank and concealed ourselves the best we could until the Chinese finally came, overran us there, and took us prisoner.
Well, and in reading your account of that incident in your book, Missing Dog Tags, the guy who was driving the tank was hit. You had to take over driving the tank. And then I vividly remember the way you described it there, because it got my attention. You basically said your head exploded. And I can't imagine what that feels like. Give us a sense of what that moment felt like for you. You're driving the tank, trying to find the road, trying to get in the right place while gunfire and artillery is going everywhere. And what happens?
Well, when you're a lot of automatic fire, the Chinese had this particular pass blocked where we couldn't get through without fighting our way through. The first tank had gone through. We had four tanks and radioed back. We were going to make individual runs at it, try to knock out their resistance so that we could get K Company. And we had over 500 American soldiers in this valley at the time trying to get out of this pass. First tank got through and radioed back and said, well, you can make it. It's all right. So the platoon leader and officer in charge of our platoon in the fourth tank said, okay, told the second tank, and we heard all the gunfire about a mile down the end of the valley, and he didn't radio back. So then the platoon leader, the lieutenant, told my tank commander for us to go, and we made a run for it. And that's when we got hit with a 3.5 bazooka and slid in behind the second tank, knocked out, and we blocked the pass entirely, two tanks. The lieutenant came in his tank about 15 or 20 minutes later, and I attempted to board his tank to get out of where I was at. I was lying behind a small slope. My tank commander had been there with me. I don't know where he went. I met him later on the death march. But I attempted to jump on the tank and was unable to do so while the lieutenant was getting. He'd got off of his tank and was pulling the dead and wounded out of the way so his driver wouldn't run over them as he came around on the sheltered side of my tank and the second tank to get his tank out of there. Well, he made it, but I never got on that tank.
No, you didn't, and you're left there to fend for yourself, not knowing what the rest of that day or any of those days would hold. And I'm curious what had to be going through your mind in that moment, because here you are all of, what, 21 years old, and you're out here in a war zone. You've just been knocked out of your tank. There's dead people all around you. How do you avoid just panicking in a situation like that?
Americans and human nature, I believe, is I've discussed this with a friend of mine just recently, and he asked me almost this same question. I think that my mind, as I recall, and that I do recall, is you're trying to figure out that your mind is racing, and you're trying to figure out the best way, or if you can, get out of the situation you're in. And I don't think that under that situation, a soldier really has time to think about fear. You're trying to get out of where you're at and move on.
And move on you did. And man, I'm really blown away by your story after having read it. 32 months in captivity, the torture, the freezing cold, the strafing from your own planes that you'd have to endure, and you even mentioned a death march. But before you were actually taken prisoner, you had an idea, I think probably in your head, of what it might be like. You had heard stories, right, of how the Chinese and North Koreans had been treating their prisoners?
Well, I'd been on armored patrol, I think, 3 or 4 times prior to this. And each time we'd go on armored patrol, there'd be 4 tanks and a couple of flak wagons and with quad 40s and quad 50s, and we'd be well protected by our take care of ourselves. And we'd come into villages where the North Koreans, we'd run the North Koreans out, or the infantry had ran them out, and we'd come up on maybe 10, 15 American soldiers with their hands wired behind them, and they'd been shot in the face on the ditches on each side of the dirt road. Or we'd find them in within the village where they'd slaughtered the North Koreans had slaughtered they call them political prisoners. Anyone that wasn't with them was against them, and they'd kill them. Men, women, children, it made no difference. Yes, I was aware of what the possibility was when I got captured.
Well, and really it seems to me that just the idea of being captured was tantamount to death, that there was no reason to believe you could survive being a prisoner at their hands.
No, there wasn't, because of the knowledge I had and the experience I had prior to being captured. And so when I was first captured, I suspected that I probably would be shot within the hour. And the men around me immediately, when we were left in a circle with guards around us, in a stand of trees, we discussed that very lightly. Well, it looks like we're going to get what we've seen the other guys get. But as it turned out, the Chinese at that point in time had released some soldiers on the line a couple of months before, or maybe a month before. And so they kept encouraging us to not feel that away, because they had a lenient policy now. And they were going to try to indoctrinate us. That was about communism. And their interpreters constantly talked to us when they had the time to explain this to us, where little by little we started to relax. Well, some, until the death march started a couple of days later, and weeks later the death toll started from starvation. And are wounded.
And you don't call it a death march for no reason. That very name implies what it was all about and what happened to many of the people on that march. And obviously when you started out, you had no idea how long they're going to march you or how far they're going to take you. You mentioned starvation. When did you get something to eat? And give us a sense of the things that began to appear to you as food that probably was never something you would imagine ingesting before.
Well, the very night of February the 11th, because of the continued activity of South Koreans trying to fight their way back in this valley, those of us that were captured from my platoon of tanks and some of the K Company infantry, they moved us about 300 yards off to the side up a small ravine, and there was an old building up there, and sometime during the night, they brought some South Korean soldiers in too, and there was maybe 60 of us at this time, and they brought out a tub of millet or sorghum cane seed. It's chicken feed boiling water, down to a mush almost. Their guards set it down amongst us and told us to eat. Well, we learned that the word savala means eat, but we didn't know what that meant then. And the South Koreans just start sticking their hands in it and eating it, and like it was the best thing they'd ever eaten. So I never tried it, but another American soldier walked over and said, hey, maybe we should try this out. These must be good, the way these guys are eating it. So he put his hand in and took a handful out and put it in his mouth and spit it out and said, my God, I can't eat that. And, of course, when he spit it out, a Chinese guard kicked him about 4 feet.
And at that time, you weren't ready to try any of that, but I'm sure over time, the more desperate things got, the more willing you were to eat things. By the end of this march, not to gross anyone out who's listening, but you were eating, by the end of your captivity anyway, you were eating kernels of corn that had actually been pulled from ox droppings?
Yes, well, dried. They use a lot of their, they're not as mechanized, the Chinese nor the North Koreans, although they did have Russian trucks, all the supplies, but they also use oxen pulling carts with either ammo or mortar shells or their food on it. And, of course, they're fed at the various villages where they lay over from coming down from China or the northern part of Korea, and they're fed corn with millet and and chopped up sorghum cane when the first man we seen pick up a paddy when we was crossing a road where oxen had been going, and they're breaking it up, and you're looking up and you see someone putting something in his mouth. The curiosity works on you till you find out what it is, and it was undigested corn, kernels of corn where they'd been fed field corn, and it passed through them whole. And any time a dried paddy could be found, if we were on a road, someone picked it up. You were very lucky if you found one.
Perhaps that's something to give you a little perspective this weekend as you prepare your football tailgate spread or sit down for Sunday dinner. Prisoners of war who make it out alive, like Ken Eaton did, as a rule, never take anything for granted. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, more of his story, including what it was like to be free again. Why don't you make your plans for observing POW MIA Day this week, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special edition in advance of Friday, September 20th and National POW MIA Recognition Day. When we left off, we were listening to the memories of the late Ken Eaton as he shared them on this program more than a decade ago. His book, Missing Dog Tags, chronicles in excruciating detail the time he spent in captivity during the Korean War.
We talked about you being captured. You escaped three times only to be captured again. Never once were you actually executed. How many times did you think that's what was going to happen to you?
Well, each time I escaped, that would be the inevitable. They would execute you for that. Generally, the guard that followed, if he was the one that we called Geronimo, he had a round face and very heavily pockmarked, and him and three or four followed the main group always behind to just catch those who was trying to escape or became too sick to continue. He took care of the wounded in that way. He'd shoot them. And that went on time and time again. In my presence, I seen that happen to other GIs who escaped and was caught, and they'd shoot them. I can only say that God and my luck and my ability to speak a little bit of the Japanese language to talk to these people saved me from being executed each time I escaped, because the threat was always there. In fact, is the second time I escaped, I dug my own grave. Well, partially dug it until I got to talk in Japanese to these two North Korean soldiers, impress them with the possibility. I think they thought I was a downed pilot, and when they had recaptured me, and it would be a feather in their hat to turn me over to their superiors, perhaps, and that stopped them from shooting me and making me finish burying and digging my own grave.
But that whole time, you're digging that grave. You're dealing with this emotion, this fear that this is it. I can't imagine what that must feel like to be digging your own grave and knowing that pretty soon, in just a few moments, you're going to be in there. Did you feel any sense of encouragement, comfort from somewhere that, you know, gave you that little inkling of hope that maybe this wasn't going to be it for you?
How your mind really works under circumstances like that. It's human nature for one to try to find a way out. You're thinking as fast as you can, analyzing every direction you look and every person around you, trying to figure out how you're going to get out of the problem you're in. And for fear to interfere with that, you're a loser. And it just didn't seem to happen to me. I don't think it happens to anyone under those circumstances, actually. They're trying to find a way out of what's happening.
And your book doesn't pull any punches that I know of. There's some intense detail in there. There are things that I think really for most of us are unimaginable, but you bring it to life. And I don't know how much you want to get into that in this interview, but I want to give you the opportunity to give our listeners a real sense of what you endured with the knowledge that you weren't the only one that endured this. Give us a sense, if you can, wherever you're willing to go, with the worst that your captors did to you. I remember one narrative in there about you waking up and there are your captors standing over you, urinating on your face. I mean, that's just a taste of some of the things. What was the worst for you, the hardest for you to endure?
Well, I think the hardest for me to endure was the actual death march. I was with something in excess of 700 soldiers, and that was all Americans. Well, some mixed UN, but very little mixed UN, and no South Koreans. And the starvation would take such a toll on us that there were so many young fellas. I was 20, and there was many 17-year-olds. Everybody had matted beards full of lice, and you couldn't tell how old anyone was. But on talking to them, you'd find out that they were kids. And the fact that the starvation to start after a couple of months took such heavy toll, we would have guys who would get down to where they wouldn't even eat a little bit that they were given. And we called it the big eye, that we'd be sitting in a room on these layovers in these villages, and one would get the big eye, and generally that person would be dead by the following morning. When we'd wake up, he'd just be sitting up against the wall or wherever he was at, and we would know the night before that we're going to lose him. And you couldn't, if you gave him a steak, he would need it, and then he'd fight you for bothering him. That was maybe ranks close to anything that maybe happened to me, is to be in that situation time and time again, staying in these villages over during the day when my friends and these young fellows would die that away from starvation.
And there's one point in the book where you talk about how many days you had been in captivity, and you talk about seeing someone die at least once a day, people that you either knew or were around, and you witnessed that. And you talk about the death march. Put in perspective for our listeners how long this death march lasted, how much ground you covered, and the conditions you had to deal with, because it wasn't just starvation that threatened to end your life.
Well, I was captured 15 miles south of the 30th parallel, and I don't know the exact mileage, but some of the officers thought we were going to walk 500 miles to get to the Yalu River. I since have been told that we walked between 250 and 300 miles on a starvation diet, which was, the walking was killing us, because of they only fed us if they found any kind of grain in these villages where the North Korean people had left because of fear of the North Korean soldiers. And if there's anything left there to be fed, that's what we ate. And if there was nothing there, we didn't eat. And some days we'd go 2 or 3 days without a single meal. And then they'd find a village larger with where they could feed us 2 meals a day for 2 or 3 days till they had to move out again. And then it was just up and down. One day you get a meal, the next day you'd get two, the next day 2 or 3 days you might not get any. And that's what took the largest toll on us. But in answer to your question, it's back to the death march and the starvation and our own airplanes. We were strafed many times by our own airplanes. They would be en route back to their base, still have ammo in their planes, and they would they would dive down on the villages to see if it was a Russian truck or any North Korean soldiers or Chinese there, and they'd strafe a few houses. And if anybody ran out, then they would maybe rocket and bomb and strafe a lot more if there's three or four planes. But the Chinese impressed us with the fact that if you come out of the house, when we get strafed, our guards will shoot you because they're dug in all around the buildings until they move us out in the evenings. And so you had to stay inside, and our own planes would kill us that way, and they didn't know it.
You know. So you guys are inside these houses, shoulder to shoulder, on the floor, up against the walls, everywhere, knowing that somebody's going to die and praying that the bullets, the shrapnel, whatever, isn't going to hit you. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, that's a fair assessment of what would take place. You just wouldn't know. A couple of times, I would try to we would find leaf tobacco when they move us into these villages. Sometimes if the place had a manger where they had, if several of them owned an oxen there that worked the fields or pulled the carts, well, they would grow leaf tobacco or buy it from another village perhaps and be dried in bundles out in the manger hanging up. And we'd find that and tear paper off the walls and make, if we didn't have any propaganda paper, to roll and make a cigarette to smoke. And at those times, one time I moved to the outside edge of a building because we were being strafed, and one of the drivers, of my second tank, who got knocked out first, was still alive, and he had told me earlier that he had found some tobacco a couple of days earlier, had some in his pocket, and I just had to have a smoke. I was so nervous about what was going on. And that only one time a plane had come down, but it was P-51s, propel craft, and they come straight down. They don't strafe like a jet, and they just scream bloody murder, and it's that alone will just almost kill you, the fear of what's going to happen when he gets closer to that village and starts pulling a trigger and firing those 50s and 30 caliber machine guns off his wings and the nose of his plane in the building. But at this particular time, they killed about 15 guys and wounded about 30. And they're in about 35 or 40 houses. The Chinese moved us out when that wing of planes left, knowing they would send someone back because someone had been outside and attracted them. And when we came back off the side of the hill later on that afternoon, when the planes finally didn't come anymore, there was about 15 or maybe 16 bodies thrown in a ravine right next to the building. They were just throwing them in like they were stacking cordwood.
And this became your daily experience, something that you were just faced with day in, day out. So there was the starvation. There was the exhaustion of marching, eventually 250 miles. There was the friendly fire from American aircraft dive bombing and strafing you on a daily basis. And then there was the weather. I mean, people in World War II talk about the Battle of the Bulge and how brutal that winter was. You guys were dealing with conditions just as bad, if not worse, 40, 50 below zero?
Yes, 40, 50. Even the winter of 50 and the 51 up until the end of February or maybe even the middle of March, that far north got 60 below. Many guys died with gangrene from having frozen feet because they couldn't get dry their feet or didn't have more socks to change like we'd had on the front lines, or had forced to wade through water, and then their feet would freeze, or they'd give us one break a night, but the break would last anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes, and we'd just freeze when we should have been up walking. Instead of having a break that long, and around midnight at night, and the guys would get feet would be black, gangrene would set in above the feet that had been frozen, and with no doctors to take care of us, ultimately a lot of those guys died. A lot of guys lost their feet, lost their toes, even some guys lost their hands because they didn't keep their hands warm from the sub-zero weather.
You talked about the horrors of that 250-mile death march, the starvation, the freezing cold, the strafing by American planes. We've also talked about the mistreatment that you received from your captors. They also wanted to indoctrinate you and convince you that communism was the best way. How did you take to that, this attempted indoctrination? They had you watch films, read books, listen to lectures. Did you kind of just shrug it off? How did you deal with that?
The lectures were at least twice a week in the camp I was in. When I finally got on the Yalu River, they had a real large building made with an auditorium with a deck on it, a stage in the far end of it. And you could probably get 300, I'm sure 300 or more of us in there, and they would rotate. They had us in this camp, had us segregated by race, by rank, and country for indoctrination. They didn't want the officers with enlisted men. They didn't want the higher rank sergeants with corporals and privates. And they segregated the black from the white, and the Spanish and Latin American people from everyone else. They even mixed them with a Hawaiian, as I recall. And they would indoctrinate us in this couple of times a week if they could rotate the camp through this building that fast. At that time, there was about 1,500 in the camp I was in. There had originally been about 5,000, and the death rate on my death march that I endured was the same thing was happening in this camp. There had been about 5,000 there, and half the camp had died off at a rate of 30 or 40 a day in the winter of 50 into 51 when I was on the death march. Anyway, the indoctrination, you had to set up. You better pay attention. They did give tests. They weren't extensive, but you had to pay attention. They would read things about and explain about Marxism and Engels and Stalinism and Mao Zedong. Seemed like everybody had written something about communism, and they wanted us all to have an understanding of that and how great it was for China and how great it had been for the Russians. And if you didn't answer some of the questions properly when they had a test a day or two later, you didn't eat for a day or two or three, or you may be thrown in a vegetable hole up by the kitchen with a bucket of water dumped over you for two or three days. And some guys didn't survive that in those, even that time of the year, because of freezing at night. Or they'd make you stand outside and dump water on you until you decided you wanted to pay attention and pass their test and pretend like you were believing some of the things they tried to teach you about communism.
And I don't want to stray too far from your individual experience, but when you step back and you look at the big picture, with that in mind, everything you just described about the way they tried to indoctrinate you, the way they wanted things to be, the way that you were treated, do you ever step back and say, you know, it was really important what Americans did there, because had we let them have their way, that our world would look a whole lot different tonight? Did that give you a glimpse of the world they wanted to come about?
Yes, the spread of communism, if they could have taken over South Korea, then their next step would have been Japan. And with the Chinese, the many millions, they have more there than the rest of the Asian nations around them there. They perhaps would have been able to do that. And we might have been fighting a different kind of war today, the spread of communism. But our defense of freedom with the Russians and with the Chinese and with the North Koreans, it's stalemated. We haven't gone anywhere beyond that, but we've stopped them also.
And one of the best illustrations I've had shared with me over the years, if people don't get that and don't see the importance of the Korean War, is that nighttime satellite photo of the Korean Peninsula. Have you seen that? With South Korea all lit up and North Korea completely pitch black.
South Korea looks like San Diego, and it's wonderful to know that.
As time goes on, I imagine there's part of you that becomes more hopeful and another part of you that becomes less hopeful, that if you've been in captivity all this time, the chances of you eventually succumbing the way so many around you have are increasing. But you had some hope. I know this because several times along the way, you took out a little spiral notebook and scribbled some notes in English, hoping that some of the civilians in the area would get those notes out and that they'd find their way back home. Did any of those notes make it home? Were your parents, was your family able to find out that you were indeed alive and not dead over there?
Yeah, yes, I had a little blue spiral notebook and a ballpoint pen my mother had included in a belated Christmas present that came to me while I was over there. And I started writing notes, giving my name, rank, serial number, my company, 2nd Division, 9th Tank. Please notify my company commander and the Air Force to stop bombing the villages. They're killing us. And please notify my mother and father. And 7 or 8 of those, when I come home, they'd gone through the War Department, and my mother and father had them in a scrapbook to show me.
And I don't want to gloss over anything, so if there's something you think is important to mention before we get to that moment, feel free. But I don't want to miss out on what that felt like to you to finally be a free man again, because here you've been beaten, you've been tortured, you've starved, you've frozen, you've been shot at by your own airplanes, and yet it's still possible for you to survive all this and to be a free man again. How did that come about, and what did that feel like?
Well, it was the most wonderful thing that that you could ever experience for a person like me and those with me. When we were hauled, taken from the camp in on a train, and then unloaded and hauled by trucks to a village nearby Pamunjom, where we were to be traded, one American soldier for maybe 2,000 Chinese or Koreans, because we had that, our army had captured that many more of them than the Chinese had left of us. Anyway, when the truck I was in was backed into Pamunjom and I was unloaded from the back of the truck, all I could see was 10 Marines in starched uniforms standing in a row. And God, we just couldn't wait to get out and touch one of them with our hands to believe, to prove to ourselves that we were free. We were free at last, and it wasn't going to be another trick.
Because you had seen plenty of those along the way. And to get back to the States, You dedicate this book to your mother and her prayers to see her again. What was that moment like?
Well, that was wonderful. My mother and my father, they met me at San Francisco when we come in a ship, and we spent some wonderful days just being together, and my brothers and sister and my sister-in-laws, and it was just wonderful. It was still hard to believe that I really was back in America on American soil. It took me weeks to trying things out and smelling things and looking at things and to believe that I really was back in America.
I can't imagine going through what you went through, and your book spells it out, like I said, in vivid detail, all the things that you endured. I can't imagine having that experience and that experience not changing your perspective a little bit. Did you find yourself back in the States trying to find some idea of a normal life again, taking less for granted or having a little different outlook on things because of what you'd been through?
Yes, I did. I had a terrible outlook on life at first, thinking every day, like I did when I was a prisoner of war, that tomorrow may not come, may never come. But little by little, I melted back into daily life. It took some months, but I melted back into daily life and learned to pick up where I had left off or been with my family prior to my going in the service. And it took several years, I'm sure, that before I was 100%, but I am there now. Thank God.
Amen. And a couple other things I want to talk to you about. You have medals displayed here in your home in Clovis, and one medal is missing that I think anybody who reads your book and sees what you went through, how you were wounded when your tank was blown up and also beaten and hurt badly in captivity. There's no Purple Heart up there, and it's not because you don't deserve it. You decided that you couldn't handle having it because of what else you saw? Explain to me that reasoning, why you didn't feel worthy of the Purple Heart.
Well, I, from the time capture and the death march and all the wounded and the ones who died from their wounds and the ones we tried to help along the trail at night to carry them until finally they succumbed to their wounds. and the things I seen and lived with in the main camp when I finally got there almost a year later, the different 17-year-olds and 35-year-olds with missing legs and shot in the face and arms missing and almost anything you can imagine, I couldn't accept a Purple Heart after being with those kind of people.
Maybe I should just speak for myself, but I'm guessing I can vouch for you too. Isn't it amazing how relatively small our problems end up seeming when we put on the perspective of an ex-prisoner of war like Ken Eaton? If you know an ex-POW, why don't you reach out to him this week? And when POW MIA Day rolls around on Friday, take some time to remember the more than 80,000 Americans still missing in action after all these years. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.